The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds.
And on the third day, Kevin McCarthy has lost more rounds of voting than there are days of the week.
We have an excellent show for you today. Pulitzer Prize winning author Stacey Schiff stops by to talk to us about her latest biography, Samuel Adams, the Revolutionary. Then we'll talk to Barbara F. Walter, author of How Civil Wars Start, who will tell us about what she sees as our democracy hangs by a thread. But first, we have NBC News's national political reporter, Jonathan Allen. Welcome to Fast Politics, John Allen.
Molly Jongfast.
Friend, countryman, you've been in Congress for 2 days now. How many times have you seen Kevin McCarthy lose the speakership?
I think we're at 8 now as we speak.
I feel like it's an advertisement for what Nancy Pelosi did. I mean, I remember reading some reporting that said, you know, she would handle people for their votes. She would call them and email them. And she had someone that the grandmother called them. You know, she was very like on it. I think this is a case for that kind of whipping.
On the one hand, it does show how effective and efficient Nancy Pelosi was. On the other hand, it shows that Kevin McCarthy is the first person in 100 years to have to go to a second ballot, much less an eighth ballot or ninth ballot or however many we might get to it. So on the one hand, Nancy Pelosi, effective and efficient. On the other hand, Kevin McCarthy, not just ineffective and inefficient in the moment, but at a historic level of the last century.
Yeah. When he said on Monday, he said, you know, he explained to us and the viewing public his plan, which was just to make everyone vote until they voted for him. Not an effective plan, huh?
Well, I mean, it's possible that we could see some retraction. We could see some, you know, we could see some erosion in the group of people who are opposed to him. But the problem with that is the people who are opposed to him are the more fanatical, the more extreme.
Right.
So they are much more likely to take things to extremes. And the people who are behind Kevin McCarthy are much more likely to look around and say, like, maybe, Kevin, if you can't do it, maybe we should look at somebody else and see if there's someone who can do it.
I mean, what is it like on the floor? I mean, this is like, in my mind, the dream of all backbench congressmen. I mean, you see congresspeople you haven't ever seen on television.
And they get their moment of fame where they get to stand up and talk about really quickly for the good of the republic, or, you know, shout out in Leroy Jenkins fashion, a vote for speaker, and then they go back away and you never see them again until the next vote. But yeah, I mean, it's true. And what's fascinating also right now is, you know, I was in the House gallery on Tuesday when the voting started and for the first couple of votes. And, you know, so when you're in the House gallery, you can see what's going on the floor. But for the first time, viewers at home are really getting a feel of what's going on behind the scenes, because there are no rules governing what C-SPAN and the cameras in the chamber can show.
Will you explain that a little bit? Because that's really interesting.
Right now, the House doesn't really exist. That is to say, because members are sworn in after a speaker is chosen, there are no members of Congress. There are no rules for this Congress. They are operating on sort of the history and precedent of how you have speaker votes. And really, the only thing that they can do is either vote or adjourn until a certain time where they come back and vote. And until that happens, they won't have rules. And because they don't have rules governing what can happen in the chamber, cameras that are in the chamber, controlled by C-SPAN, can basically zoom in on whatever they want. Usually when there are rules in the House, they are limited in what they can do. They're limited in what angles they can show and who they can show on the floor. And so viewers at home are getting a much more intimate story about what's actually going on in the House floor. When you see Matt Gaetz and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez conferring with each other, I asked her about that the other day. I said,
what did she say?
She said, I was fact-checking Kevin McCarthy.
Oh.
So McCarthy will tell Republicans, hey, if you don't do X, then the Democrats are going to vote for me or whatever. And then, you know, so Gaetz is checking with Ocasio-Cortez to find out what it is the Democrats are really going to do or not do. And she's, you know, apparently, according to her, giving him some information about that. Today, you could see Kevin McCarthy, you know, sitting down with Andy Clyde, one of the recalcitrant Republicans, for a very long period of time, you know, just chatting him up, looking like he was trying to win over a vote. You don't get to, I mean, you get to see that if you are a reporter who sits in the gallery above the House chamber in, you know, important vote situations. Sometimes you see stuff like that. Viewers at home very seldom get to see it. So that's so fascinating about what's been going on this week.
So it is this situation like with C-SPAN, where C-SPAN is not being ruled right now by the speaker.
Correct. Whereas it is typically limited by the rules of the House, which, you know, the speaker puts forward a package of rules once there's a speaker, and then the House votes on it. And, you know, typically the majority party supports the rules and the minority party votes against them, because the rules are designed to help the majority party and harm the minority party for the most part. And one of the rules that's, you know, you see every 2 years limits what media can be in the galleries and what those media can do.
So let's talk for a minute about where this goes now. We have this incredible fracas going. Was that the last vote where Matt Gaetz nominated Donald Trump?
Matt Gaetz did vote for Donald Trump after saying yesterday that it was Gaetz's word, not mine. Sad that Donald Trump had come out so hard in favor of Kevin McCarthy.
So, I mean, they're nominating a lot of different people that they don't expect to win. What Lauren Boebert said she wanted was that she wanted a one person mandate for this rule to vacate the chair. So that would make it completely impossible to be speaker. I thought that McCarthy actually acquiesced to that, though.
Yeah, that offer is on the table now to go from five votes to one vote to make a motion to vacate the chair. The House would still have to have a full vote of the House. But you can imagine that if Lauren Boebert wanted to vacate the chair, wanted to get rid of the speaker and brought that motion to the floor and there was a vote on it, that all of the Democrats would support her in that.
Right, right.
And then Kevin McCarthy would be just a couple votes away from getting thrown over the side.
Right.
And, you know, if you have to continue to have those votes over and over again, even if you're winning them, it's deeply embarrassing. And it, you know, is a tactic that could be very obstructionist in terms of trying to get legislation passed. If it had a, you know, sort of a privilege, meaning that it had to be brought to the floor within a certain time period, you could see that being used to prevent the House from acting on things like spending bills or raising the debt ceiling to, you know, retain the full faith and credit of the United States.
So we have these 20 and one has now started to, it was 19. And then you had one who was this abstaining, who's now, and these are sort of the crazies. And then you have Hakeem Jeffries, who keeps winning. I mean, not winning enough to win, but he does get Democrats continually vote for him. There's no world in which Republicans could, like, accidentally make Hakeem Jeffries the Speaker.
It could conceivably happen, but they would immediately undo it.
Okay. But it is like amazing, right? I mean, he does keep winning even though he's losing.
It will not happen.
Right.
Republicans would have to vote for Hakeem Jeffries for that to happen.
Right.
That's not going to happen. So I think one of the things that's really important to remember about this speaker vote, unlike a lot of elections, is it's not that you need a plurality of votes. If that was the case, Hakeem Jeffries would already be the speaker.
Right.
He only
right,
needed
right.
the most votes out of the... You need a majority of those who are present and voting.
218, unless you lose some people and then it goes down, right?
Right. Meaning if there are people who vote for someone or something that is not an actual living human, those votes don't count. So
right.
if someone votes for Mickey Mouse or for Dwight Eisenhower, their vote doesn't count. Or if people vote present, those votes come out of the denominator. Or if people are simply absent, those votes come out of the denominator. So it would be possible if... Trying to do the math here, if roughly a dozen or so Republicans didn't come to the floor, it would be possible for Hakeem Jeffries to win. I think if it was 13 or 14 Republicans, basically didn't vote, it would be possible for Jeffries to win a majority of those voting. But it's inconceivable to me that that would actually happen. And if it did, it would be immediately corrected. I mean, the body is designed for the majority party to run it.
Do we think that this is Steve Scalise's moment and he, as he once referred to himself, forever to live in infamy, David Duke without the baggage? So hardly a unity candidate, but do you think this is the moment in which this is his moment?
Look, I mean, if you're Steve Scalise, you're in a box.
Right.
Which is that if you were to go out there and start whipping against Kevin McCarthy and stand for nomination against Kevin McCarthy, like McCarthy will get more votes than you will.
Right.
So if you're Scalise, you have the same death lock that they're in now.
Right. Well, you have to wait until people get desperate for another candidate.
You have to wait until McCarthy, basically withdraws.
Right.
At which point then you see if Steve Scalise has 218 votes, which he may or may not. But he has to be very careful because as long as he's not campaigning for this job and he is seen to be loyal to McCarthy, then there's a possibility that McCarthy withdraws and McCarthy's people go to Scalise. If Scalise is seen as screwing with McCarthy, then there may be some McCarthy people that decide to screw back with him.
Right. And that could end up in 154 votes. Probably not, though. I mean, eventually people are going to be like, this is because right now it's Schrodinger's Congress, right? It neither exists nor doesn't exist, right?
I mean, that's right. It exists in the sense that there's a Senate, although they're not meeting either right now. And then there's a House with a bunch of Congress people elect. Like, they are not members of the Congress yet, and they don't have the rights of members of the Congress yet. And so, it is a body that is operating without any structure or rules, and sort of depending on everyone's civility to observe the sort of two basic rules that they've had, which is that you keep voting until you have a speaker, or you adjourn for a specific amount of time. And even those votes are getting hard for McCarthy to win, to be able to adjourn for some hours.
Right. I saw that they were having some trouble getting the numbers last night. And now they're going to have to adjourn again today, right?
At some point, you would expect that to happen. Although, in theory, they could just keep the House floor open in perpetuity and keep voting.
Wouldn't that be just a nightmare for all parties involved?
Well, it will exhaust people, which would mean that one level, House Republicans who support McCarthy may get cranky with him earlier. On the other hand, it may be that there are some Democrats at 3 o'clock in the morning that decide they don't really want to show up. McCarthy can't count on that. So he has to be sensitive to the needs and desires of the people who support him. And some of them will want to go home at night.
How do you see this going? Predict for May.
I wish that I could. It's one of the rare times where you're watching a vote in Congress and it's unpredictable what will happen. And this, by the way, this is the one I was talking to somebody who used to work for Nancy Pelosi today. And they said, she would never bring something like this to the floor without having the votes already. And I was like, but this is the one vote where the leader doesn't have any control over when it happens, meaning the Constitution provides for for the House to meet at noon on January 3rd. And the first thing is for them to vote for speaker. So, if you're the leader, if you're the Speaker of the House, most legislative issues, you can choose, when to bring it to the floor. You don't bring it to the floor until you have the votes. In this case, McCarthy had really no choice.
Right. He's been running for speaker since 2015.
I mean, at least. So he's had plenty of time. But just to that small point of in this particular case, there was a fixed, it's very unusual, fixed date and time for a vote. He was not ready by that deadline, even as he tries to make up for having missed that deadline, he's not getting it. It's like a student who misses a test, right? Or like, you know, and then shows up and they're like, all right, well, I got all this extra homework. And the teacher's like, yeah, that's not going to do it. And come back with another set of homework. All right, what about this? No, that's not going to do it. Just keep coming back.
I mean, where do you see this going if you have to predict? And by the way, I will make fun of you for this if it's not right. So go.
Yeah, that's why I'm not predicting, Molly. I don't want to be the object of your scorn and derision.
Doesn't it seem that every passing day, Steve Scalise looks a little more likely or no?
Yes, it is more likely with each passing day that the people who support Kevin McCarthy look in another direction. And Steve Scalise makes the most sense because he's the person who's won the most votes in a leadership election before.
Right. He's number two.
Correct.
So
he's the most obvious choice. But if there was a very obvious choice, that person would have come forward already.
If that happens, do you think that Kevin McCarthy will stay in Congress, you know, just to fill out his term and then leave? I mean, that will be so traumatic for him.
Yeah, I think nobody will think about Kevin McCarthy ever again.
Yeah.
Doesn't win the speakership. And I think he knows that, which is why he's continuing to have this fight. I mean, yeah, like presumably he'll like go outside and make some money, you know, as an advisor to somebody or, you know, like a pseudo lobbyist, you know, he'll be hired as, you know, somebody to give advice and counsel to some lobbying firm. And so he won't actually have to register, but he'll make like gazillions of dollars, you know, trying to influence his former colleagues.
Right. Makes sense. Well, very moral and ethical. One last question here for you, my friend, John Allen. These 19 or 20 holdouts, a lot of them are Trump supporters, Lauren Boebert, Andy Biggs, Matt Gaetz. Trump did make a full throttle endorsement of Kevin McCarthy. What happened?
So this is amazing, Molly. So Trump has been working these guys for quite a while behind the scenes. He's had conference calls, he's had one-on-ones, and he has been trying to get them to vote for McCarthy. My colleague, Garrett Hake from NBC, called him on Tuesday, and he said, you know, what's going to happen? McCarthy's going to, and Trump said, we'll see what happens, which was very, you know, very quickly got out into the ether.
Right.
People were like, wait, what? And the McCarthy people were like, wait, what?
And McCarthy had gone to Trump like a month after Trump had done the insurrection, you'll remember. Yeah, he had pretty much given up everything for Trump.
He bent all the knees. And so there's this reaction to Trump's sort of weak sauce, like, we'll see what happens with McCarthy kind of response. And then Trump comes out Wednesday morning, he's like, full-throated endorsement of Kevin McCarthy. Then all the people that were voting against McCarthy, as you point out, like all friends of Trump, all big allies of Trump, stayed against Kevin McCarthy. They were unmoved.
Right, they were unmoved, yes.
Completely, like Donald Trump had no ability to influence them on the next vote or any of the subsequent ones that we've seen so far. I talked to Ralph Norman, a congressman from South Carolina, about it yesterday. He said he was on a conference call a couple weeks ago with Trump and like, just doesn't see eye to eye with him. And he said, basically, this isn't Trump's fight. I respect the guy, but like, this is an internal House matter, and I'm not listening to him on it. You saw Lauren Boebert go out yesterday on the House floor and kind of shame Trump and say, look, we're your friends. You're my favorite president. You shouldn't be calling, telling us to sit down and shut up or to knock it off. You should be calling Kevin McCarthy and telling him to withdraw. So all these people, and the thing is, Trump has to kind of walk this careful line because he needs this set of people in the House. He needs these allies to be out there for him as he seeks the presidency again. He can't afford to alienate the House Freedom Caucus.
Well, and I think he also sees that he's diminished.
I mean, it's obviously frustrating him deeply. He's had, you know, he's been out campaigning for president now, and I say out campaigning for president by that, I mean, he's been in Mar-a-Lago campaigning for president for about 6 weeks now. You couldn't tell that he's campaigning for president. The most newsworthy thing he's done since the election was to have a meal with Kanye West and the white supremacist Nick Fuentes.
Which really bit him.
I mean, everything has been going poorly for Donald Trump, you know, arguably since the 2020 election, but certainly over the course of the last 6 weeks. And then, you know, he goes to show how influential he can be on behalf of McCarthy. And proves just the opposite.
Yeah. So interesting. John Allen, thank you. Will you please come back?
I will come back anytime you ask. Every time you ask.
Yay.
With bells on for New Year's.
The best.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stacey Schiff is the author of The Revolutionary Sam Adams.
Welcome to Fast Politics, Stacey Schiff.
Thanks so much, Molly. I'm delighted to join you.
Well, I'm so happy to have you. And, you know, we don't have that many Pulitzer winners.
You have a lot of people with some pretty laser insights, however.
Right. But I wanted to talk to you about your new book, which is called The Revolutionary Sam Adams. How did you get here and why did you write this? And tell us how you got involved with this.
A couple of things came together. It was 2016, as if any explanation is required. I was searching for some kind of solid ground. I think like many of us, I was thinking a lot about what democracy was and how we had got where we were. And in the course of that, I had realized that Samuel Adams made a cameo in my Ben Franklin book, and I had never really given him much thought. And went back to read about him and was struck by how much his contemporaries call him out as the man of the hour. To a man, they write him down as the most active, the earliest, the most persevering man of the revolution, the father of the revolution, and yet he has largely been lost to us. So it was in large part that sense of, you know, how did we end up where we are? How instrumental was this man? And then topping that off was my sudden sort of realization of my own ignorance in that we all know that Paul Revere jumps on a horse in April of 1775, but I anyway had never really thought about where he was going. Mm. And where he was going was to warn Samuel Adams and John Hancock they were about to be arrested or assassinated by British forces. And so it was sort of an attempt to bail myself out of my own lack of understanding that I finally fell down the Samuel Adams rabbit hole, which is not an unhappy place to be during these years.
Right. I mean, what did you learn?
Well, you know, what you learn very quickly is that he essentially writes what you could today call the Bible of civil resistance theory. I mean, this is 10 years before the real shots are fired, the 10 years that precede 1776, or the 12 years, depending on how you count, what John Adams would refer to as the revolution in hearts and minds. It's the revolution in thinking that precedes the revolution in fighting. And what's surprising is, first of all, the entire sea change that is affected in those years, how messy and nonlinear those years are. It really is a protest movement. It proceeds by fits and starts. And how essential one person, and in fact, one fairly flawed person, can be in effecting that change.
Oh, that's really interesting. Why was he flawed?
Well, I think that you could say that the attributes that served him so well for those dozen years, basically, to some degree turn against him. He's undeviating, he's unwavering, he's remarkably resolute, and proceeds with a kind of sort of serene confidence in the essential righteousness of his convictions. And that's all very true. And that serves him beautifully and serves the country beautifully. But after the revolution, when the country is being put back together, those same attributes, I think, fail him. I think that there is a rigidity in a funny way in the thinking that came in very handy when it was time to upset the apple cart, and come in less handy when it's time to establish a government.
I mean, why was he lost to history?
He somewhat erases himself from the record. And part of that is simply protection of himself and his colleagues, given their seditious activities. John Adams leaves us this sort of horrible account of Samuel Adams sitting in Philadelphia in front of his fire, feeding his papers to the fire. And John Adams says to his cousin Samuel, "You know, don't you think you're maybe overreacting a little bit?" And Samuel Adams responds that he doesn't want any of their friends to suffer for his negligence. So there's really an attempt to make this, you know, the no fingerprints school. This, you know, this is treason at this juncture. No name should be mentioned. It's very important that this be a collective responsibility, and that no one particularly be able to be singled out. So to some extent, he erases the record. He's an extraordinarily modest man, and there is a sense that he prefers to be in the wings throughout much of this history. He very much likes to promote people like John Hancock, who prefer the spotlight. And in the end, as I said, his popularity wanes, and he is somewhat tarred by criticism of his former colleagues after the revolution. And for those reasons, as well as the fact that he stood for a somewhat set of antiquated principles, I mean, he really stands for a kind of purity and simplicity, as opposed to the more commercial, more opulent nation that is kind of racing ahead of his somewhat antiquated ideals. He's also not a Federalist, so he really falls out with much of the popular feeling post-revolution.
But he is related to two of the presidents.
Correct. He is actually the person who will recruit John Adams, who's a little over a decade younger than he. And in fact, in John Adams's first accounts of him, John Adams really leaves us some of the best descriptions of Samuel Adams. And John is utterly starstruck by his cousin.
Right.
He goes on about his, and in a way that defies, I think, our standard sense insofar as we have one of Samuel Adams as this kind of hot-headed rabble-rouser. John is very clear about the fact that he's a man of great affability, very decorous, very charming, much erudition, as he puts it, exquisite humanity. He's a very prudent thinker and a very calculated, shrewd tactician, but he's also just an immensely sort of sweet and charming man.
Like, are the people remembered by history the blowhards?
I think there's no question that history belongs not so much to the blowhards as to the eloquent. Certainly John Adams survives as well as he does. I mean, obviously he's a man of immense accomplishment.
Right, but he's not a blowhard.
Not a blowhard, right, but wrote the best letters. And I think those of us who worked a lot in the 18th century possibly overstate John Adams's role in things because he's so eloquent. But yes, I mean, a really great way to go down in history would be to grab the microphone. That won't surprise any of us, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's just interesting because you think of the Adamses, they're their own sort of weird self-loathing. I always think of that family, you know.
There's that real sort of Puritan modesty, which doesn't come in handy when you want to be remembered by history. I mean, I should add also that much of Adams's work is work that he publishes under pseudonyms. And you know, he's a master of propaganda in the press, and he's writing under at least 30, if not more, pseudonyms. So that too, I think, contributes to, it's difficult to connect him sometimes to his work because pseudonymous writing was the nature of editorial writing or political writing in the day. It's very hard, therefore, to credit him with all of his accomplishments.
Interesting. So you think that there are things we don't know?
If you add up the pseudonyms that other people have identified and ones that I've newly brought to the table, you come to about 30 or 31.
Wow.
And I'm sure that we're missing quite a few. I mean, it's difficult because he's often credited with pieces other people wrote, incorrectly credited, and then other pieces are credited to other writers, which may well have been his. You know, I suspect if you really wanted to, you could feed all of the Boston Gazettes of those years through some sort of AI, and you could figure out where we've lost him. But you know, you can see points where he cribs from his own letters in pieces. We know those articles are his. We know from other people's notations in their copies of newspapers that those articles are his. But I'm sure that there are pieces that have eluded us still.
Very interesting. What are the lessons that we can learn from this?
I think the greatest one is how essential communication is. This is someone who was able to really just clarify these very large principles and somehow funnel them into this very convincing editorial writing that he does. So there really is just the sense of being able to sort of pull an ambient concept out of the air and articulate it in a way that makes it almost irresistible. He's able to do something which has a lot of resonance today, which is that he unites the elite, he unites the well-educated. He holds 2 degrees from Harvard, but is as comfortable in the streets with a bricklayer or someone who works on the wharves to unite the top and the bottom. And that sense that the government was unresponsive, that government was in the hands of a very tight oligarchy, is something that he peddles and gets an enormous amount of mileage out of and uses as a demonstration close at hand of the tyranny abroad. I guess what I'm saying here is that sense of inequality and how explosive inequality can be is something that obviously we should be paying attention. It's dangerous when inequality doesn't have its limits. He's really reacting against a sort of feeling of disenfranchisement, a feeling that government is unresponsive because it is in the hand of these political dynasties. And I think that feels very relevant today.
It does. How should we sort of think of him in this pantheon?
I suppose that he's the master communicator in the sense that he translates these concepts more ably to the page and to a wider readership than anyone else had done in years where questions of independence were really nowhere on the radar, and is able to capture the sense of resentment that people had. John Adams tells us that when he and Samuel Adams meet for the first time, which would have been in the early 1760s, before the Stamp Act, they're both agreed that Thomas Hutchinson, then the lieutenant governor, poses a greater threat to American liberties than any other man in existence. So that sense that there is this elite who have too much power in their hands and that the government has to be redistributed in some way is something with which Adams is deeply dedicated.
That's quite interesting. What are you working on next?
I have been unable to separate myself from Samuel Adams, so I'm working on another op-ed about him and another aspect of the book that I feel like I'd either like to go back and rewrite or I'd like to expand upon. And since it's easier to expand upon it than it is to go back and rewrite it, that's what I'm working on for now.
Oh, fantastic.
Can I add one more answer to your question?
Please, please, please.
When you ask about a modern parallel,
yeah,
I think the other piece to which we've not paid enough attention is that there is this explosion of media at the time. And Adams capitalizes on that in a really almost unfathomably brilliant way. Suddenly, there's this explosion of newspapers. It will leave the crown officers in Boston writhing. You know, how can you govern a town with 5 newspapers, one of them says. And the fact that you suddenly have papers which are being passed hand to hand, read by often 9/10 of the town, pieces which you can write in Boston and publish in Boston, in New York and Philadelphia, a connection among the colonies on which Adams is very intent from the beginning. You suddenly have this ability to communicate from town to town and from colony to colony. And it's really that effort in which Adams is hugely instrumental that makes the revolution take off with the speed that it finally takes off after the Boston Tea Party.
That's really interesting. You've written so many important biographies. I'm curious, if you look back, who are the characters that sort of stick with you the most?
You mean which one is my favorite child?
Well, I wasn't going to ask that, but you know, the ones that come back to you, like pieces of their lives come back to you.
I think that Ben Franklin gets the award for the subject with which you cannot finish because he's so protean and so much a modern man. And even in writing this book, I always sort of had Franklin at the back of my mind, because in many ways, he's the counterexample to Samuel Adams. He's abroad for all of these years. And in fact, in Samuel Adams's mind, Ben Franklin is insufficiently revolutionary during these years, because Franklin is still intent on holding together the British Empire. But I think the answer would probably be Franklin. Technologically speaking, he's so much a man of the future, and he anticipates so much of the modern world, and is a master psychologist in much the way that Adams is, but in a way that in the back of your mind, you're watching something happen at the dinner table and you're thinking, oh my God, Franklin, you know, had an epigraph about this, you know, years ago. So I think it's Franklin I probably carry around with me more tightly than anyone else.
Oh, that's really interesting. This was really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was a great delight. Thanks so much.
I know you. Our dear listeners are very busy, and you don't have time to sort through the hundreds of pieces of punditry each week. This is why every week I put together a newsletter of my five favorite articles on politics. If you enjoy the podcast, you will love having this in your inbox every Friday. So sign up at fastpoliticspod.com and click the tab to join our mailing list. That's fastpoliticspod.com. Barbara F. Walter is the author of How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them. Welcome to Fast Politics, Barbara F. Walter.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
We're so thrilled to have you. I want to talk to you about the book, How Civil Wars Start, and I think a very important little ending on this, and how to stop them. So how do civil wars start?
They generally actually start quite slowly. Usually it's started by a handful of people. They're almost always extremists. They're operating on the fringe of society. It takes them years to get off the ground. And while they're doing this, the rest of the country is going about their business. They're not thinking about it. They're not concentrating on it. And then it's usually a series of events that allows these tiny movements to grow. One of them can be, if it's in a democracy or kind of a partial democracy, it can be the loss of a series of elections. So you start to get people who had been sort of more moderate becoming more dissatisfied. And then these radicals start to listen to these radicals. Another way these movements tend to grow is if there's some events. It's usually a protest, and the police or the government goes in and overreacts and reacts to the protesters really harshly. This could have happened on January 6th. You know, people talk about the Capitol Police and how they didn't do anything on January 6th, and they talk about this as a criticism. But for somebody who studies how these movements grow, I actually think that was a gift to the American people, because had they responded, and especially if they'd responded harshly, all of those insurrectionists with their cameras would have caught this on tape. They would have crafted a narrative around how the federal government is overreaching, how they hate patriots, and it's those situations that also allow these movements to grow.
That's a pretty interesting idea right there. I want to talk to you about that. So you think it's sort of like the Archduke Ferdinand, right? Is that the kind of way that happens?
Well, that was the trigger for World War I. Nobody's ever asked me that question.
Sorry.
Is it like the Archduke Ferdinand?
That's a little bit of a stretch. But, you know, the idea that there's violence that then creates a kind of, it's interesting. So is that sort of is that really, you feel like, largely the catalyst for civil wars?
Here's the challenge that these extremists, these radicals on the fringe have in the early parts of a movement. They are more radical than most people in a country. In fact, they're more radical even amongst their own population. Every country has people who are, you know, more passionate about an issue, or they're willing to fight for something. And people kind of look at them and nod their heads and they say, you know, yeah, they're kind of crazy, we're going to ignore them. But these extremists are constantly talking to the moderates, telling the moderates, listen, the government's really bad. You need to pay attention. We need to do something about this. The country's going in the wrong direction. And again, moderates tend to ignore them. So extremists, if they're going to grow the movement, and that's really hard, if they want to become something more than just a handful of these guys, they have to somehow convince the moderates that what they're saying is true. And one of the things that they do is they try to provoke a really strong government reaction to something. And if the government comes into their neighborhoods or the government starts bashing heads, then this, in some respects, provides this evidence to moderates that what the extremists have been saying is true. Now, let me give you an example. The Irish Catholics in Northern Ireland had been unhappy with being under British rule forever, since the 1920s. They peacefully protested in the 20s. They peacefully protested in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. They weren't getting anywhere, and yet they continued to sort of try to work within the existing regime. The IRA had been around for most of that time, and they kept telling Irish Catholics, peaceful protest is going to get you nowhere. We need to shift to a violent strategy. And Irish Catholics just wouldn't do it. You know, the IRA was saying the British government really was never going to let them be treated well. They were always going to allow Protestants in Northern Ireland to run the show. And that's just the way it was going to be. And the Irish Catholics didn't believe it. So when Protestants started to get more aggressive about protesters, when they started going into their neighborhoods and started hitting innocent civilians with their batons, the British government did send British soldiers to Northern Ireland. And the Irish Catholics were thrilled. They're like, finally, right. Finally, the government's paying attention. They can see how undemocratic this is. They can see how poorly treated we are. They're coming here to help us. And there was this enormous hope that things were going to change and that they were going to be proven right and the IRA was going to be proven wrong. And instead, the British soldiers came in and they started to use counterinsurgency tactics against the Irish Catholics, going door to door, house to house, dragging men out of their homes and throwing them into prison without trial. And suddenly this radicalized the population. Suddenly they saw that, in fact, what the more radical elements of their population were saying was true. The IRA now suddenly had the evidence that the IRA was saying was true. And you saw a certain portion of just average Irish Catholics support the IRA. And that's when you started to see violence expand.
Oh, that's really, really interesting. So tell us a little bit about how one stops a civil war, because that, I think, is an anxiety that many of us have, though I think some of us feel a little better after these midterms. And by some of us, I mean me.
So we actually know the two conditions that really are very predictive of a country experiencing a civil war. The first is whether it's an anocracy, and that's just a fancy term for a partial democracy. It turns out that full, healthy democracies, places like Denmark and Switzerland and Canada, almost never experienced civil wars. It also turns out that full autocracies, the North Koreas, the Saudi Arabias, the Bahrains of the world, they also rarely experience civil war. The violence tends to happen in this middle zone where democratic institutions are weak. They're often in transition. You have lots of instability. These are the times when individuals and groups who want to try to grab power, they take advantage of those times. And, you know, oftentimes they'll use violence to try to gain control.
Where we are as a country is the most dangerous.
Where we were in December of 2020.
Right. Yeah. When Trump was leader.
We've since improved, and there are lots of people who had a big sigh of relief when Trump left office. There were lots of us who were really happy with the midterms, and we kind of feel like, okay, we're on more stable ground. And in some respects, we are. Yes, Trump left office. That's a really good thing. January 6th failed. That's a really good thing. Lots more voters, especially young voters, went out to vote, and all of these election deniers who tried to gain office, many of them were unsuccessful. But the reality is that our institutions, our democratic institutions that have been weakening since 2016, nothing has changed there. The Democrats have been trying to initiate certain reforms, but they don't have the votes for it. And Republicans have no interest in reform because as long as they continue to play to a predominantly aging white evangelical Christian base, which is a demographic that's declining faster than any other demographic here in the United States, as long as they continue to play to that base, they can't win elections if we are truly a full and equal democracy.
That's really quite interesting. So anyway, so go back to what we can do to get out of it.
Ifanocracy, partial democracy, and oh, and I didn't talk about the second factor. The second factor that is a big risk factor for civil war is whether a country is a partial democracy and its political parties are based on identity. If its political parties are predominantly based on race, religion, or ethnicity, as opposed to political ideology. So if you think about Yugoslavia after the fall of the Soviet Union, when Yugoslavia attempted to democratize rapidly, one of the things that these ethnic entrepreneurs within the Serb and the Croat community did is they quickly started to build political parties, not over any issue, like are you a conservative or a liberal or a communist or a capitalist, but whether you were ethnically Serb or ethnically Croat. When you have countries that start to do this, those are also the countries that tend to have a much higher risk of civil war. So if these are the two conditions, anocracy and these ethnically based parties, then, you know, that gives us two things that we can do. If we strengthen America's democracy, if we get rid of these undemocratic features like the filibuster and gerrymandering, if we reform perhaps the Senate, if we create an independent election commission to run our elections instead of putting it in the hands of party leaders, all of these things would make our democracy stronger. And again, stronger democracies don't tend to experience civil war. And if our political parties, both of them, both the Republicans and the Democrats, were willing to reach across racial, ethnic, and religious lines, that would go a long way. The problem is that we're not seeing really either of those patterns happening. And so, you know, usually people ask me, okay, if those are hard to do, if those solutions are not likely to be implemented in the near term, what can we do now? And my answer is actually that the simplest thing that we can do now, the biggest bang for our buck, will come from a regulating social media. The five biggest tech companies in the world are all U.S. companies. And one of the things that we're beginning to find out is that the algorithms that they've developed to keep people engaged with content are disproportionately pushing out the most incendiary material, information that tends to make people feel threatened and scared and insecure and angry. They're selecting out the more extreme material and they're pushing it out there. One of the effects that's having is not only to increasingly polarize the population, but to increasingly foment ethnic nationalism, ethnic hatred. And again, if here we have an industry and a media outlet, the only media outlets that are not regulated, we are increasingly seeing that they're having all sorts of negative societal effects. And to date, we've done nothing about it.
I want to talk for a minute about Elon Musk, because right now, as we tape this, we have Richard Spencer, the Nazi, is hosting a space on Twitter. What do you think the consequences of this kind of free speech absolutism? This is the most generous way to describe what he's doing. Probably too generous. Explain to us what you think the problem here is.
I'm going to say something provocative, which is I'm less concerned about a neo-Nazi going on Twitter and writing things or being interviewed than I am about the algorithms that are going to take those interviews or take those tweets and push it out to tens of millions of Twitter followers. And I think this is something that most people don't understand. The tech companies that run these social media platforms, their business model is to maximize profits. And they maximize profits by keeping people engaged on their platforms as long as possible. And they've brought in all sorts of social psychologists. They've run all sorts of experiments on groups of people to try to figure out what keeps people on their devices the longest. And they have discovered that we human beings, because we have these sort of, you know, old limbic brains that have allowed us to survive this long, those limbic brains are very, very attuned to anything that could possibly be a threat to us. And so when we're in you know, a sea of information, our brains will select out the more negative material, the material that makes us feel like we might have to trigger our fight or flight response. And it's not the rainbows and butterflies. It's not the positive messages. It's not the calming messages. And so if you're Elon Musk or if you're Mark Zuckerberg, and you basically want people on their phones or on their laptops as long as possible, you're going to design your algorithms to pick out this type of material, whether it's true or not. And in fact, whether it has really bad implications for anxiety and depression in teenage girls or political violence. And that's exactly what's happening now. And it's allowed to happen because there's absolutely no regulation. So, you know, have this guy Spencer on Twitter. I don't care. If algorithms didn't exist, you would actually have to search to find him. It would be work to find him.
Right, right, right. That's a good point.
Instead of just going to your Twitter feed and boom, seeing it right there on top and then scrolling down. And if it's a really popular interview, then seeing it again and again and again.
Right. That's a good point.
And you're doing absolutely nothing to find that. It's being pushed to you. You know, it's the same thing, you know, Amazon, you know, they've been tweaking this, but the Bible of the Far Right is this book called The Turner Diaries. It's a fictitious account of a civil war in the United States, essentially a race-based war by white supremacists to take over the federal government. But it's really a primer on how you would launch a war against a powerful government like the United States. Timothy McVeigh had pages of the Turner Diaries in his pickup truck when he bombed the federal building in Oklahoma City. And if you look at videos of January 6th, one of the Proud Boys was holding up the book when he was being interviewed by a journalist and saying, "You need to read this book." The book talks about how you would attack FBI headquarters. It talks about how you would attack the U.S. Capitol. It talks about how you would put up a gallows outside the Capitol so that when you arrest, quote unquote, arrest traitorous government officials, you could put them on trial for treason and then hang them up on a gallows. It's all there. So in December of 2020, I went to Amazon to purchase the Turner Diaries. And when I purchased it, you know how Amazon recommends, if you like this book, you'll like all these other books. Well, it was a who's who of white supremacy material. You could buy Mein Kampf by Hitler. You could buy deeply anti-Semitic books. You could buy, the whole cornucopia of awful material. Now, Amazon, to its credit, right after January 6th, took the Turner Diaries off its website. You can no longer purchase it there. I wasn't looking for 10 additional books to tell me how to wage, white supremacy here in the United States. It was pushed into my feed. And that's the danger of algorithm.
Jesus. Barbara, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back.
I would love to, Molly. And thank you for being interested. And thank you for everything you're doing.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money in markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC.
we dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.